Chapter 9. The Theodore Snitz commercial squeaked,
"In the presence of strangers, do you feel you don't quite exist? Do they seem not to notice you as if you were invisible? On a bus or spaceship, do you sometimes look around you and discover that no one, absolutely no one, recognizes you or cares about you, and quite possibly may even..."
With his carbon dioxide-powered pellet rifle, Maury Frauenzimmer carefully shot the Nitz commercial as it hung pressed against the far wall of his cluttered office. It had squeezed in during the night, had greeted him in the morning with its tinny harangue. Broken, the commercial dropped to the floor. Maury crushed it with his solid, compacted weight and then returned the pellet rifle to its rack.
"The mail," Chick Strike Rock said. "Where's today's mail?"
He had been searching everywhere in the office since his arrival. Maury noisily sipped coffee from his cup and said,
"Look on top of the files, under that rag we used to clean the keys of the typewriter."
He bit into a breakfast donut, the sugar-covered type. He could see that Chick was behaving oddly, and he wondered what it signified. All at once, Chick said,
"Maury, I've got something I wrote out for you."
He tossed a folded piece of paper onto the desk. Without examining it, Maury knew what it was.
"I'm resigning," Chick said. He was pale.
"Please, don't," Maury said. "Something will come along. I can keep the firm functioning."
He did not open the letter. He left it where Chick had tossed it.
"What would you do if you left here?"
"Emigrate to Mars."
The intercom on the desk buzzed, and their secretary, Greta Troop, said,
"Mr. Frauenzimmer, a Mr. Garth McCrae to see you with several other gentlemen in a group."
"I wonder who they are," Maury wondered. "Don't send them in yet," he said to Greta. "I'm in conference with Mr. Strike Rock."
"Go ahead and conduct your business," Chick said. "I'm going. I'll leave my resignation letter there on your desk.
Wish me luck." "I wish you luck."
Maury felt depressed and ill. He stared down at the desk until the door opened and closed, and Chick had gone.
"What a hell of a way to begin the day," Maury thought.
Picking up the letter, he opened it, glanced at it, folded it up once more. He pressed a button on the desk intercom and said,
"Miss Troop, send in the name you said, McCrae or whatever it was, and his party."
"Yes, Mr. Frauenzimmer."
The door from the outer office opened, and Maury drew himself up to face what he recognized at once to be government officials. Two of them wore the gray of the National Police, and the leader of the group, evidently McCrae, had the bearing of a major official of the executive branch, in other words, a highly placed gi. Rising clumsily to his feet, Maury extended his hand and said,
"Gentlemen, what can I do for you?"
Shaking hands with him, McCrae said, "You're Frauenzimmer?"
"Correct,"
Maury answered. His heart labored and he had difficulty breathing. Were they going to close him down, as they had moved in on the Vienna School of Psychiatrists?
"What have I done?"
he asked, and heard his voice waver with apprehension. It was one trouble after another. McCrae smiled.
"Nothing, so far.
We're here to initiate discussion of the placing of an order with your firm. However, this involves knowledge of a gi level. May I rip out your intercom?"
Pardon?
Maury said, taken aback. Nodding to the NP men, McCrae stepped aside. The police moved in and swiftly made the intercom inoperative. They then inspected the walls, the furniture. They examined scrupulously every inch of the room and its equipment, and then they nodded to McCrae to continue. McCrae said,
"All right. Frauenzimmer, we have specs with us for a sim we'd like constructed. Here."
He held out a sealed envelope.
"Go over this. We'll wait."
Opening the envelope, Maury studied its contents.
"Can you do it?"
McCrae asked presently. Raising his head, Maury said,
"These specifications are for the Ulta."
Correct.
McCrae nodded.
Then that's it, Maury realized. That's the piece of ghee knowledge. I'm now a ghee. It's happened in an instant. I'm on the inside. Oh, too bad Chick left. Poor goddamn Chick. What bad timing. Bad luck on his part. If he had stayed 5 minutes longer.
It's been true for 50 years, McCrae said.
They were drawing him in, making him as much a part of this as possible now.
Good grief, Maury said. I never guessed, watching it perform on TV, making its speeches. And here, I build the damn things myself.
He was staggered. Carp did a good job, McCrae said, especially on the current one, Rudy Kolbfleisch. We wondered if you had guessed.
Never. Not one time.
Not in a million years.
Can you do it? Build it?
Sure.
Maury nodded.
When will you start?
Right away.
Good. You realize, naturally, that initially NP men will have to be kept here to ensure security maintenance?
Okay, Maury murmured. If you have to, you have to.
Listen, excuse me a moment. He edged past them to the door and through to the outer office, taken by surprise they permitted him to go.
Miss Troop, did you see what way Mr. Strike Rock went?
He just drove off, Mr. Frauenzimmer, toward the Autobahn. I guess he went back home to the Abraham Lincoln where he lives.
You poor guy, Maury thought.
He shook his head. The Chick Strike Rock luck still functioning. Now he began to feel elated.
This changes everything, he realized. I'm back in business. I'm caterer to the king. Or rather, I supply the White House. Same thing. Yes, it's the same thing.
He returned to his office, where McCrae and the others waited. They eyed him rather darkly.
Sorry. I was looking for my sales chief. I wanted to pull him back due to this. We won't want to take any new orders for a while, so we can be free to concentrate on this.
He hesitated. As to the cost...
We'll sign a contract,
Garth McCrae said. You'll be guaranteed your costs plus 40%. The Rudy Kolbfleisch we acquired for a total net sum of $1 billion, plus, of course, the cost of perpetual maintenance and repair since the acquisition.
Oh, yeah, Maury agreed. You wouldn't want it to stop working in the middle of a speech.
He tried to chuckle, but found he could not.
How does that sound,
roughly, say between 1 bill and 1.5?
Maury said thickly,
Fine.
His head felt as if it were about to roll off his shoulders and plunge to the floor.
Studying him, McCrae said, You're a small firm, Frauenzimmer. You and I are both aware of that. Don't get your hopes up. This will not make you a big firm such as Karp und Sonnenwerker. However, it will guarantee you continued existence. Obviously, we're prepared to underwrite you, economically speaking, for as long as is necessary. We've gone exhaustively into your books. Does that petrify you? And we know that you've been operating in the red for months now.
True, Maury said.
But your work is good, Garth McCrae continued. We've minutely inspected examples of it, both here and where it actually functions on Luna and Mars. You display authentic craftsmanship, more so, I feel, than the Karpwerker. That, of course, is why we're here today, instead of there with Anton and old Felix.
I wondered, Maury said.
So that was why the government had decided this time to let the contract to him, not Karp. He thought, did Karp build all the De Alta simulacra up to now?
Good question. If this were so, what a radical departure in government procurement policy this was. But better not to ask.
Have a cigar,
Garth McCrae said, holding an Optimo Admiral out to him.
Extra mild, pure Florida leaf.
Thank you.
Maury gratefully and fumblingly accepted the big greenish cigar. Both he and Garth McRae lit up, gazing at one another in what all at once had become calm, assured silence. The news posted on the Abraham Lincoln's communal bulletin board that Duncan and Miller had been chosen by the talent scout to perform at the White House astounded Edgar Stone. He read the announcement again and again, searching for the joker in it and wondering how the little, nervous, cringing man had managed to do it. "There's been cheating," Stone said to himself. "Just as I passed him on his Relpol tests, he's got somebody else to falsify a few results for him along the talent line." He himself had heard the jugs. He had been present at that program, and Duncan and Miller, classical jugs, simply were not that good. They were good, admittedly, but intuitively he knew that more was involved. Deep inside him, he experienced anger, a resentment that he had ever falsified Duncan's test score. "I put him on the road to success," Stone realized. "I saved him. And now he's on his way to the White House, out of here entirely." No wonder he and Duncan had done so poorly on his Relpol test. He had been busy practicing on his jug, obviously. Duncan had no time for the commonplace realities which the rest of humanity had to cope with. "It must be terrific to be an artist," Stone thought with bitterness. "You're exempt from all the rules and responsibilities. You can do just as you like." "He sure made a fool out of me," Stone said to himself. Striding rapidly down the second floor hall, Stone arrived at the office of the building sky pilot. He rang the bell, and the door opened, showing him the sight of the sky pilot deep in work at his desk, his face wrinkled with fatigue.
Father, Stone said, "I'd like to confess. Can you spare a few minutes? It's very urgently on my mind. My sins, I mean."
Rubbing his forehead, Patrick Doyle nodded.
"Jeez," he murmured, "it either rains or it pours. I've had 10 residents in today so far using the confessionator."
"Go ahead."
He pointed wearily to the alcove which opened onto his office.
"Sit down and plug yourself in. I'll be listening while I fill out these 410 forms from Berlin."
Filled with righteous indignation, his hands trembling, Edgar Stone attached the electrodes of the confessionator to the correct spots of his scalp and then, picking up the microphone, began to confess. The tape drums of the machine turned slowly as he spoke.
"Moved by a false type pity," he said, "I infracted a rule of the building. Mainly, I am concerned not with the act itself, but the motives behind it. The act is merely the outgrowth of a false attitude toward my fellow residents. This individual, my neighbor, Mr. Ian Duncan, did poorly on his recent Relpol test, and I foresaw him being evicted from the Abraham Lincoln. I identified with him because, subconsciously, I regard myself as a failure, both as a resident of this building and as a man, so I falsified his score to indicate that he had passed. Obviously, a new Relpol test will have to be given to Mr. Ian Duncan, and the one which I scored will have to be marked void."
He eyed the sky pilot, but there was no evident reaction.
"That will take care of Duncan and his classic jug," Stone said to himself.
By now the confessionator had analyzed his confession. It popped a card out, and Doyle rose to his feet to receive it. After a long, careful scrutiny, he glanced keenly up.
"Mr. Stone," he said, "the view expressed here is that your confession is no confession. What do you really have on your mind? Go back and begin all over. You haven't probed down deeply enough and brought up the genuine material. And I suggest you start by confessing that you misconfessed consciously and deliberately."
"No such thing," Stone said,
or rather tried to say. His voice had gone out on him, numbed by dismay.
Perhaps I could discuss this with you informally, sir. I did falsify Ian Duncan's test score. That's a
fact. Now, perhaps my motives for doing it,
Doyle interrupted. Aren't you jealous of Duncan now? What with his success with the jug, White House swords?
There was silence.
This could be, Stone rasped in admission at last. But it doesn't change the fact that by all rights, Ian Duncan shouldn't be living here. He should be evicted. My motives, notwithstanding. Look it up in the communal apartment building code. I know there's a section covering a situation such as this.
But you can't get out of here, the sky pilot persisted, without confessing. You must satisfy the machine. You're attempting to force eviction of a neighbor to satisfy your own emotional, psychological needs. Confess that, and then perhaps we can discuss the code ruling as it pertains to Duncan.
Stone groaned, and once more attached the intricate system of electrodes to his scalp.
All right, he grated. I hate Ian Duncan because he's artistically gifted and I'm not. I'm willing to be examined by a 12-resident jury of my neighbors to see what the penalty for my sin is, but I insist that Duncan be given another Relpol test. I won't give up on this. He has no right to be dwelling here amongst us. It's morally and legally wrong.
Well, at least you're being honest now.
Actually, Stone said, I enjoyed Jug Band playing. I liked their little act the other night, but I have to behave in a manner which I believe to be in the public interest.
The confessionator, it seemed to him, snorted in derision as it popped a second card. But perhaps it was only his imagination.
Oh, you're just getting yourself deeper and deeper,
Doyle said, reading the card. Look at this. He grimly passed the card to Stone.
Your mind is a riot of confused, ambivalent motives. When was the last time you confessed?
Flushing, Stone mumbled, I think last August. Pepe Jones was the sky pilot then. Yes, it must have been August.
Actually, it had been early July.
A lot of work will have to be done with you,
Doyle said, lighting a cigarillo and leaning back in his chair. The opening number on their White House program, they had decided after much discussion and hot argument, would be the Bach Chaconne in D. Al had always liked it, despite the difficulties involved, the double stopping and all. Even thinking about the Chaconne made Ian Duncan nervous. He wished, now that it had at last been decided, that he had held out for the much simpler Fifth Unaccompanied Cello Suite. But too late now. Al had sent the information on to the White House A&R secretary, Mr. Harold Slezak. Al said, Don't for heaven's sake worry. You've got the number two jug in this. Do you mind being second jug to me?
No,
Ian said. It was a relief, actually. Al had the far more difficult part. Outside the perimeter of Jalopy Jungle No. 3, the Papula moved, crisscrossing the sidewalk in its gliding, quiet pursuit of a sales prospect. It was only 10 in the morning, and no one worth collaring had come along as yet. Today, the lot had been set up in the hilly section of Oakland, California, among the winding, tree-shrouded streets of the better residential section. Across from the lot, Ian could see the Joe Lewis, a peculiarly shaped but striking apartment building of 1,000 units, mostly occupied by very well-to-do Negroes. The building, in the morning sun, appeared especially neat and cared for. A guard, with badge and gun, patrolled the entrance, stopping anyone who did not live there from entering.
Slezak has to okay the program, Al reminded him. Maybe Nicole won't want to hear the Chaconne. She's got very specialized tastes, and they're changing all the time.
In his mind, Ian saw Nicole propped up in her enormous bed, in her pink, frilly robe, her breakfast on a tray beside her as she scanned the program schedules presented to her for her approval.
Already she's heard about us, he thought. She knows of our existence. In that case, we really do exist. like a child that has to have its mother watching what it does. We're brought into being, validated consensually by Nicole's gaze. And when she takes her eye off us, he thought, then what? What happens to us afterward? Do we disintegrate? Sink back into oblivion? Back, he thought, into random, unformed atoms, where we came from, the world of non-being, the world we've been in all our lives, up until now.
And, Al said, she may ask us for an encore. She may even request a particular favorite. I've researched it, and it seems she sometimes asks to hear Schumann's The Happy Farmer. Got that in mind? We'd better work the Happy Farmer up, just in case. He blew a few toots on his jug, thoughtfully.
I can't do it, Ian said abruptly.
I can't go on. It means too much to me. Something will go wrong. We won't please her, and they'll boot us out, and we'll never be able to forget.
Look, Al began, we have the Papula, and that gives us...
He broke off. A tall, stoop-shouldered, elderly man in an expensive, natural-fiber gray suit was coming up the sidewalk.
My God, it's Luke himself, Al said. He looked frightened.
I've only seen him twice before in my life.
Something must be wrong. Better reel in the Papula, Ian said.
The Papula had begun to move toward Loony Luke. With a bewildered expression on his face, Al said,
I can't.
He fiddled desperately with the controls at his waist.
It won't respond.
The Papula reached Luke, and Luke bent down, picked it up, and continued on toward the lot, the Papula under his arm.
He's taken precedence over me, Al said.
He looked at Ian numbly. The door of the office opened, and Loony Luke entered.
We got a report that you've been using this on your own time for purposes of your own, he said to Al, his voice low and gravelly. You were told not to do that. That Papula belongs to the lot, not to the operator.
Al said,
Oh, come on, Luke.
You ought to be fired. But you're a good salesman, so I'll keep you on. Meanwhile, you'll have to make your quota without help.
Tightening his grip on the Papula, he started back out.
My time is valuable. I have to go.
He saw Al's jug.
That's not a musical instrument. It's a thing to put whiskey in.
Al said,
Listen, Luke, this is publicity. Performing for Nicole means that the network of Jalopy Jungles will gain prestige. Got it?
I don't want prestige, Luke said, pausing at the door. There's no catering to Nicole Thibodeau by me. Let her run her society the way she wants, and I'll run the jungles the way I want. She leaves me alone, and I leave her alone, and that's fine with me. Don't mess it up. Tell Slaves Act you can't appear and forget about it. No grown man in his right senses would be hooting into an empty bottle anyhow.
That's where you're wrong, Al said. Art can be found in the most mundane daily walks of life, like in these jugs, for instance.
Luke, picking his teeth with a silver toothpick, said,
Now you don't have a Papula to soften the first family up for you. Better think about that. Do you really expect to make it without the Papula? He grinned.
After a pause, Al said to Ian,
He's right. The Papula did it for us, but...
Hell, let's go on anyhow.
You got guts, Luke said, but no sense. Still, I have to admire you. I can see why you've been a top-notch salesman for the organization. You don't give up. Take the Papula the night you perform at the White House and then return it to me the next morning.
He tossed the round bug-like creature to Al. Grabbing it, Al hugged it against his chest like a big pillow.
Maybe it would be good publicity for the jungles, Luke said meditatively. But I know this. Nicole doesn't like us. Too many people have slipped out of her hands by means of us. We're a leak in Mama's structure. and Mama knows it. Again he grinned, showing gold teeth. Al said, Thanks, Luke, but I'll operate the Papula by remote. I'm a little more skilled than you. After all, I built them.
Sure, Al said. I'll have my hands full playing anyhow.
Yes, Luke said. You'll need both hands for that bottle.
Something in Luke's tone made Ian Duncan uneasy. What's he up to? He wondered. But in any case, he and his buddy Al Miller had no choice. They had to have the Papula working for them. And no doubt Luke could do a good job of operating it. He had already proved his superiority over Al just now, and as Luke said, Al would be busy blowing away on his jug. But still...
Looney Luke, Ian said, have you ever met Nicole?
It was a sudden thought on his part, an intuition.
Sure, Luke said steadily. Years ago, I had some hand puppets. My dad and I traveled around, putting on puppet shows. We finally played the White House.
What happened there?
Ian asked. Luke, after a pause, said,
She didn't care for us. Said something about our puppets being indecent.
And you hate her, Ian realized. You never forgave her.
Were they? He asked Luke.
No, Luke answered. Sure, one act was a strip show. We had Folly's girl puppets, but nobody ever objected before. My dad took it hard.
But it didn't bother me.
His face was impassive. Al said, Was Nicole the first lady that far back?
Oh, yes, Luke said. She's been in office for 73 years. Didn't you know that?
It isn't possible, both Al and Ian said almost together.
Sure it is, Luke said. She's a really old woman now. Must be. A grandmother. But she still looks good, I guess. You'll know when you see her.
Stunned, Ian said,
Well, on TV.
Oh, yeah, Luke agreed. On TV, she looks around 20.
But go to the history books.
Except, of course, they're banned to everyone except guests. I mean, the real history texts, not the ones they give you for studying for those RELPOL tests. Once you look it up, you can figure it out for yourself. The facts are all there, buried down somewhere.
The facts, Ian realized, mean nothing when you can see with your own eyes that she's as young-looking as ever, and we see that every day.
Luke, you're lying, he thought. We know it. We all know it. My buddy Al saw her. Al would have said if she was really like that. You hate her. That's your motive.
Shaken, he turned his back to Luke, not wanting to have anything more to do with the man now. 73 years in office. That would make Nicole almost 90 now. He shuddered at the idea. He blocked it out of his thoughts, or at least he tried to.
Good luck, boys, Luke said, chewing on his toothpick.
It's too bad, Al Miller thought, that the government cracked down on those psychoanalysts. He glanced across his office at his buddy Ian Duncan.
Because you're in a bad way, Al realized.
But actually there was one of them left. He had heard about it over TV. Dr. Superb or something like that. Ian, he said, you need help. You're not going to be able to blow that jug for Nicole, not the way you're feeling.
I'll be okay, Ian said shortly.
Al said, ever been to a psychiatrist?
Couple times, long ago.
You think they're better than chemical therapy?
Anything's better than chemical therapy.
If he's the only psychoanalyst still practicing in the entire USEA, Al thought, he's no doubt swamped. Couldn't possibly take on any new patients.
However, for the heck of it, he looked up the number, picked up his phone, and dialed.
"Who are you calling?"
Ian asked suspiciously. "Dr. Superb, the last of the..."
"I know! Who's it for? You? Me?"
"Both of us, maybe," Al said.
"But primarily for me."
Al did not answer. A girl's image, oh, she had lovely, enlarged, high-rise breasts, had formed on the screen, and in his ear her voice said,
"Dr. Superb's office."
"Is the doctor accepting any new patients at this time?" Al asked, scrutinizing her image fixedly.
"Yes, he is,"
the girl said in a vigorous, firm tone of voice.
"Terrific,"
Al said, pleased and surprised. "I and my partner would like to come in, whenever it's possible, the sooner the better." He gave her his name and Ian's.
"What about Friday at 9:30 in the morning?"
the girl asked.
"It's a deal," Al said.
"Thanks a lot, miss. Ma'am." He hung up violently.
"We got it," he said to Ian. "Now we can thrash our worries out with someone qualified to render a professional assist. You know, talk about mother image. Did you see that girl? Because..."
"You can go,"
Ian said.
"I'm not."
Al said quietly, "If you don't go, I'm not playing my jug at the White House. So you better go." Ian stared at him.
"I mean it," Al said.
There was a long, awkward silence.
"I'll go,"
Ian said at last.
"But once only, no more after this Friday."
"That's up to the doctor."
"Listen,"
Ian said.
"If Nicole Thibodeau is 90 years old, no psychotherapy is going to help me."
"You're that much involved emotionally with her? A woman you've never seen?"
"That's schizophrenic.
Because the fact is, you're involved with..." Al gestured.
"An illusion. Something synthetic, unreal."
"What's unreal and what's real? To me, she's more real than anything else, than you even. Even than myself. My own life."
"Holy smoke," Al said. He was impressed. "Well, at least you have something to live for."
"Right,"
Ian said and nodded.
"We'll see what Superb says on Friday," Al said.
"We'll ask him just how schizophrenic, if at all, it is." He shrugged. "Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it isn't."
"Maybe it's Luke and I who are the insane ones," he thought. To him, Luke, for example, was much more real, much more an influencing factor than Nicole Thibodeau.
But then, he had seen Nicole in the flesh and Ian had not. That made all the difference, although he was not sure quite why. He picked up his jug and began practicing once more. And after a pause, Ian Duncan did the same, joining in. Together, they puffed away.